My heart has no words. My eyes have no tears left. Mind had done gone crazy. Went off and married my fears. Now I'm standing here with nothing left to tell you. I'm standing here with nothing to prove. I got nothing to prove.
Hello, this is Amy, and I'll be your host tonight for Voices. And today I'm interviewing my stepmother, Sandy. Sandy's been a part of my life since I was probably 4 or 5. Oh, she's giving me the three fingers. Since I was 3 years old. And I guess technically she's not legally my stepmother anymore because she and my father are divorced, but I still consider you my mother. We've always had a close relationship, and I asked her about, I don't know, maybe 6 months ago, if I could interview her for Voices, because I think she has a really interesting story based on where she came from, how she found the church, and her experience leaving the church. So I'm going to introduce my stepmother, Sandra, and I say that because she's Southern. So, Mama, why don't you introduce yourself?
Well, I'm Sandy, and I was born in New Orleans, and we moved to Baton Rouge when I was 2. I lived in Baton Rouge very happily with my dad and mom until my dad passed away when I was 7, which was without a doubt the biggest catastrophe of my life.
At what time period did you grow up in the South? Because that's it's a crucial time period for America in general.
Right. I was born in 1948. And so I grew up during the 50s, 60s, and 70s, which was a pivotal time for the American experience.
So what was it like being in the South during all that civil rights stuff? Because you had Negro help in your home, as I know that Grammy would have called them.
Colored people.
Mm-hmm. So you had staff. And what was that like? What did they do?
They were absolutely wonderful to me. In those days, it was similar to what the gentry in England have. The children were not raised by their parents. They were raised by the staff. And to this very day, the speech of a Southern black person, a kind Southern black person, moves me to the core.
I bet. And so the nannies and the maids and the staff helping raise you, what was the relationship like with your mother, with Grammy?
Well, it changed. When my mother and my father was still living, and he passed away at 39 from malignant hypertension. So when my mother and father were still together before his death, I had a very different relationship. My father was my primary caretaker in those days. And my father and I would do fun things like fish, go walking on the beach, go to movies. I was his little buddy. He'd take me everywhere with him. And he was an anesthesiologist and worked out of the home. And he also worked with wood and metal. He had a metal lathe in his shop and would make all kinds of metal and wooden things.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And so was Grammy just sitting in the parlor reading magazines?
That's what she did. We would go down to Daytona Beach, Florida, and she would stay in the room and do her nails while my dad and I went out and walked on the beach and went swimming and fishing. I still remember a time when my dad and I went to a piling on a wharf. We broke off live oysters and ate them, and they were salty from the ocean.
Oh, wow.
It was wonderful. He always carried a knife, and he used his knife to pry off the live oysters.
So he was a real hands-on dad.
Oh, yeah. And he was a real, real man's man.
Now, you mentioned that your father died when you were young.
7.
7. And that would pain any child. However, based on the fact that you were so close and how you found out about his death, made a huge impact on you. Can you share that a little bit?
Yeah. They had done everything in the world to try to keep him alive. He kept having strokes.
And you didn't know any of this, correct?
Yes, I did.
Oh, you did?
Well, all I knew was that my dad was home a lot and that he was sick.
Okay.
And he was home all the time. But they were trying to do everything they could think of to keep him alive. And the last ditch effort they made was called a lumbar sympathectomy. They took him to Boston and did this operation. And he had a terrible stroke. And he went blind. And he was dead for a couple of weeks before I even knew he was dead. I was not included in any of the death process or the death ceremonies. He was interred, and the funeral had been held before I even knew he was dead. And when my mother had gone to New Orleans with my father when they returned to Louisiana, and she came back to the house in Baton Rouge. And I said, not at all interested in having my mom home.
Right.
I said, well, where's Daddy? And she broke down. And my father's brother, Horace, was with her. And he said, your daddy's dead.
And what was life like after that?
Well, my mother and I were never close. I didn't identify with her at all. I totally identified with my father. All of our interests were the same. Boating, sailing, walking on the beach. He had read the entire Encyclopedia Britannica. He was absolutely brilliant and totally devoted to me. He called me Babo.
Oh, and you were an only child, correct?
I was an only child, and he wanted a daughter desperately. And he named me Sandra so I could be called Sandy.
Oh.
So, my father was a sailor, a recreational sailor, and he was a member of the New Orleans Yacht Club, and he used to sail in races. And when I got older, in my later teens, I was very interested in sailing and had a boyfriend, Jack, and he and I would run every time there was a storm. He and I would run to Lake Pontchartrain and take the sailboat out so we could sail in the storm.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
You were reckless.
Oh, we were. Wow.
Now, part of your growing up in the South also was the social responsibilities of an upper-class young woman.
Exactly.
So tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it was all about the country club. Growing up in Baton Rouge, well, we moved to Baton Rouge until I was 2, and we lived in Baton Rouge until I was 17. When my mother remarried and we moved back to New Orleans.
Okay.
So I was raised at the country club. My mom's idea of daycare was dropping me off at the country club in the morning and picking me up at the country club in the evening before dinner, at which time I would swim, I would race swimming, I would take racing, swimming lessons, diving lessons, tennis lessons, I would eat and go in the clubhouse and pass my days in happy, dreamlike experience with all my friends who had a common background.
And when you got older, you were introduced into proper society.
Yes, I was a debutante.
And what did you think of all that? Coming from this connection you had with your father, which was a lot more earthy and hands-on and going out and living in the real world, and now you're living this fancy taffeta life to be presentable. What did you think of all that?
You know, I loved it.
You did?
Yes. And not only was I a debutante, but I was a maid in 2 Mardi Gras balls and queen of 1 Mardi Gras ball.
Well, hello.
Yes, ma'am. And so what happened was I had been just this wild, out of control young teenager. I went to several high schools, and they kept kicking me out.
Why?
Because I wouldn't obey the rules. I was loud. I was just...
Were you smoking in the bathroom?
No. Well, I was smoking. But I was loud, and I ignored the rules, and I wasn't a lady. I went to school at Stuart Hall in Virginia, and I got kicked out of that because I wouldn't follow any of the rules and I was way too loud. Then my mom put me in a school, All Saints Episcopal, in Mississippi, where they threw me out because I was absolutely incorrigible. So then, after that, I went back to the large high school in Baton Rouge, Baton Rouge High, and my friend Tebow and I...
Not the Tebow,
but this was the original Tebow. The others are all copies, but this guy was the original Tebow, and he was probably all right out gay. But he and I would go out at lunch, and we would guzzle beer every day. I would guzzle a quart of beer at lunch.
My Lord.
And then go back to school. And at 15, I started going to bars. And I also started having sex at 15. So I had been a very bad girl. So what this whole thing constituted, well, also, at 17, my mother's wedding present for me was an unwanted pregnancy.
Oh, boy.
Yes. And so at 17, when we moved to New Orleans, my mother wanted to put me in St. Martin's Episcopal School. And my grades were so bad, but my test scores were so good that they said, okay, we will be happy to take her on the basis that she will start again, not as a senior, but as a junior, and repeat her junior year and graduate from here. So that was the agreement. But before I went to St. Martin's, this was during the summer before I went to St. Martin's when we discovered this unwanted pregnancy. And I went to Tijuana and had an abortion.
And back in those days, because it was pre-Roe v. Wade, there was a lot of little steps and the minutiae of having that done.
Right.
And you had to go through a lot of steps to find a doctor that would refer you to another doctor
right.
that would tell you where to go.
Right.
And one can assume that in Tijuana, most things are not pleasant. This was probably...
It was miserable. They didn't give us any real anesthesia. The only anesthesia they gave us was when we started screaming too much, and then they would give us a little bit of gas. Because they couldn't have a lot of white women hanging around getting general anesthesia in Tijuana, Mexico.
Right.
So they came. We stayed in a motel. My mom and I stayed in a motel in Tijuana. And they came by in a station wagon, and we had to wear scarves so they wouldn't know that we were a bunch of white girls that were being picked up and brought to a certain clinic where we were going to receive abortions. Then, after I got the abortion, I began hemorrhaging. So they took me downstairs back to the operating suite and did a further D&C, and then they delivered us all back to our parents. Back in the same station wagon with scarves around our heads.
That must have been horrid.
It was horrible.
And how was your mother during this? Was she supportive?
She was great.
She was great.
I couldn't believe it. She, like, came through like a champ. I didn't think I was pregnant because I hadn't been with a guy since we moved to New Orleans. And I had been spotting regularly. So I didn't think there was any chance I was pregnant. So I told my mom that I had been spotting, but I hadn't had a real period in a long time. So she took me to Dr. Susie, who was the man who delivered me. And he said to my mom, we've got a problem about a 3-month pregnancy. But she was great. She said, honey, it's up to you. You can have this baby. Or you can get an abortion. We will support you in whatever your choice is. But I knew that had an unwanted pregnancy, and she and her husband lived in a dump, and her life was ruined.
Well, and also coming from the status in your social circle would have probably prevented you from marrying well.
Absolutely. It would have been death, social death.
Wow. So tell me a little bit about what kind of religious upbringing you had growing up with your dad before he died and then after he died.
Okay. My mom would go to church every Sunday. She was very religious, Bible and prayer and everything like that. And my father and I would stay home and make pancakes. But she was Methodist. But after my father died, the Methodist minister was so uncomforting to my mother that she converted to the Episcopal religion. But my grandmother Mayer, this was Grandmère for the French. Anyway, I called her Mayer instead of Grandmère. But Mayer was a Bible thumper from way back. And I would lay in bed at night and my grandmother would read to me from the Bible. And whenever there was discord, which there was frequently,
yes,
between my mother and my grandmother and I, she would tell me how the Lord was displeased in me and how I was going to burn in hell. And she would quote chapter and verse to demonstrate to me that I was going to burn in hell.
And what did this do to you?
I was in agony.
Because you were convinced you were going to burn in hell.
I was convinced that I was evil and I was going to burn in hell.
And how did so when your mother converted to Episcopalian, did you attend church with her?
Yes. Yes, I did in Baton Rouge.
And was it the same fire and brimstone experience? Or?
No, no.
So it was just Mayer that kind of gave that loving burning in your bosom.
Right.
The early burning.
You got that.
What did you think of God?
I thought God was punitive and that I would never be reconciled with God. But see, what happened was after I had my abortion, I had been thrown out of three schools. I had acted out terribly in Baton Rouge with going out with Tebow at lunch every day. And after I got my abortion, it was like I did a 180 and I had to clean up my life. I went to this very demanding prep school. I made A's in everything. That was when I was the maid in the Mardi Gras ball in New Orleans, and when I was the queen of the Mardi Gras ball in New Orleans, and then I made my debut. And it was like I had been restored because I had then turned myself around and been nothing but a good girl.
So were you less afraid of burning in hell, or were you still pretty convinced that that was going to be what happened?
No, but I felt like I really had to live by the rules then.
Yeah, this was your only chance now.
Right.
Okay. So when you graduated from high school and you started your college days, what year was that?
I graduated in 67.
Okay. Right about the time of Summer of Love.
Summer of Love.
Tell me about that transition, because I know you didn't stay at home. You went away to college.
Well, I started in New Orleans. I started at Loyola, which is a Jesuit Catholic school. And I had been going out with this neighbor, the next door neighbor, Jack, the one that I sailed with. I'd been going out with Jack since I was a junior in high school. And Jack and I were like bunnies. But I had learned how to use birth control.
Praise
so there
God.
Was no way I was ever going to get pregnant again. So then when I went to Loyola, I'd broken up with Jack. And I started going out with a law student. And that was when, of course, Steve and I were f***ing like bunnies, too. And he lived with his parents. And we watched The Moonwalk from his bed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
God, it sounds like an episode of Mad Men.
I know it. I know it.
So when did you, now, eventually you left Loyola and went to, was it Texas? Didn't you go to Texas?
Yeah, I went to the University of Houston.
Okay. And what did you study?
Psychology.
Okay.
Yeah. But see, that was when I was 21, I was still in Houston. So when I was living in Houston, this was when I got my inheritance. And I went, well, who needs school? And you know what? It was kind of the ruination of me because I never realized my potential. Because my plan was to get a PhD in psychology and be a therapist. But because I got this money and I said, well, who needs school? I've got everything I want.
Right.
I dropped out.
Well, and also that was, I'm sure that there was a lot of that, the new social norm for your age group was to break away from everything that
right.
was what their parents did.
Exactly.
And that was schooling, and you were just going to go live free on the prairie.
Exactly.
So tell me a little bit about that transition when you left school and you became your hippie self.
Well, in Houston, we would just, all I did after I dropped out of school was sleep in and party, smoke weed, eat. Bob, okay, I had my money then, and Bob was getting his PhD in psychology, and Bob really, really took advantage of me. I bought him a Porsche.
Jesus.
Yes, and he wasn't satisfied with having an old Porsche, so he decided he needed a new Porsche. So I bought him a new Porsche, and I took him to Greece, and then Bob got his first job in California. But we moved to California together with the understanding that we were not a couple.
And you were in the midst of your hippiedom, would you say?
No, actually what happened was got involved with the telephone counseling service and started to meet a lot of friends. And this is when I became a quasi-hippie. I grew my pit hair. I grew my leg hair. And I just felt beautiful. And I felt very, very desirable. And I just had all kinds of relationships. And they were beautiful. They were gorgeous. And all the in those days, it was the yin and yang of the universe coming together. And something very, very beautiful and spiritual grew out of the union of male and female. And it was elevating. And glorious. It was a good thing. And so this took its form in going up into the mountains for music festival and living up there for days on end and just having music and drugs and just endless amounts of marijuana and dancing mm-hmm. and just beautiful people and men and women in tree houses. Above the lake where everybody was swimming naked and a sweat lodge where everyone would cover themselves in mud, wear long dresses and no bras. And, oh, God, it was great.
Wow.
Those were the great days. Those were the days before herpes and before AIDS and before killer viruses. Those days will never be regained. It's just all become ugly and dark now. But in those days, it was just bright and lovely. And I'm glad I lived through that. I'm glad I have that in my memory bank. Because you know what? It's enabled me to be a better parent.
How so?
Because I've been able to go with my kids when they've gone through their ups and downs and not condemn them. And just love them and nourish them as they have blossomed and grown into human beings. And that was how I ended up in Fresno.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that brings us to where our lives began
exactly.
together. So my mother and father, your former husband.
Yes.
Were LDS.
Yes.
And were either in getting ready to divorce, in the middle of the divorce, or divorcing. And you and my dad met, I believe, at Royal Robbins. Camping store.
Right.
Okay.
It's like Wasatch Touring.
Okay. And at that point, Dad was just a big old hippie grizzly bear, right?
Grizzly bear, yeah. Long beard.
And just everything you probably ever thought was a man.
Yes. Yes. He was a climber. Which I was so taken with. Just the whole romance of being a mountain climber.
How did you guys meet? What were you there for?
Well, I had gone to Fresno because of Bob. And then I rented a house. And I didn't have any friends. I didn't know a single soul. I was getting this house put together. And I would go to a store and talk to the clerk, and the sound of my own voice was foreign to me. So then I became aware of a place that was, I'm not sure exactly what it was called, but it was one of the telephone call-in counseling volunteer opportunities.
Like so, a suicide hotline.
Yeah, that people would call in if they were in crisis. And so I volunteered as a phone counselor, and this was my entree to the social world, to friendships in California.
So you made friends with a bunch of crazy people.
I made friends with a bunch of people who wanted to help crazy people.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And enter my father.
Enter your father. Okay. So this, I was seeing a therapist, and he said, Sandy, if you want to meet the kind of men that you will be interested in and that will be interested in you, then you have to be doing the things you love. And one of the things that was at the top of my list was cross-country skiing. So the way I met your father was I was being my typical obsessive-compulsive self. And I got on the phone, and I called every mountaineering and skiing shop in town to see what kind of skis they had and how much they were and everything. And then I called Robbins Mountain Shop, and this guy had the sexiest voice I had ever run across. I said, I got to meet this man. So I got in my car and drove out to Robbins Mountain Shop immediately. And there was your father. And we started talking. And he said, I got to sit you down. And we sat down and we started to click and talk. And I came alive under his eyes.
Oh, of course. And he's the most charismatic.
Oh, yeah.
And just absolutely knows how to read a person, to really engage them.
Yes,
so I'm
exactly.
Sure you felt really important.
I did. I just opened up to him, and I just thrived in his gaze.
Now, at this point, Dad had he been excommunicated at that point?
No, not yet.
Okay. When did he introduce the idea of, or not the idea, the fact that he was Mormon and that perhaps was going to be excommunicated? When did that come up?
Well, that came up after we had been living together for a while.
So you didn't know he was Mormon when you started living together?
Well, let's see, did I know? Yeah, I knew. And also, it was like he started drinking.
Uh-huh.
And he had never had drunk in his life.
Right.
And he would drink and just vomit because he was just totally unaccustomed to it. But I knew he was Mormon, but I was introducing him to the wild and crazy life of a wild and crazy quasi-hippie girl in California.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. But the way he introduced me to the Mormon church was I was studying a comparative religion class. And I was just so excited, just thriving and just on fire about the issue of comparative religion. So he and I would stay up until 2 o'clock in the morning talking philosophy and religion. And that was when he presented to me the philosophy of the Mormon church. And then I would counter with all kinds of other philosophies. Hinduism, Buddhism,
Islam?
Islam, Jainism, and we would talk and talk, and he was such a charismatic representative of the Mormon church and upheld it so beautifully. I'd never met a Mormon.
Right.
I didn't know anything about the Mormon church except what he told me, and what he told me I thought was beautiful, and he defended it beautifully. So I wanted that.
Now, one thing probably is good to understand about Dad is that he really believes in the mystical Mormonism.
Exactly.
The mystical Joseph Smith.
Yes.
So what do you recall at all what it was that he would, the things that he was saying to you about Mormonism? Do you have any recollection of how he was selling it to you?
Well, I love the idea of getting clean. and the concept of baptism and just redeeming myself for all the bad girl things that I had done in my life. I mean, this harks back to when I had my abortion and I cleaned up my life. But then I dirtied up my life again, and I lived as a hippie, and I like a bunny. And then this whole thing of the Mormon Church presented me with an opportunity to clean up my life.
Did you find it all strange that he was preaching, not preaching, but kind of proselytizing to you this idea of cleaning up your life while he's in the midst of drinking his gin and tonic and vomiting on the porch?
Right. Well, see, that's one of the elements of your dad that has always mystified me. I call it compartmentalization. He can hold two absolutely opposed concepts in his mind, and they don't conflict for some reason.
When he finally was excommunicated, when did you decide to get baptized? I mean, he was being excommunicated and you're being baptized.
Right.
Was that strange?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, I wanted him to be a Mormon man, and I was into being a 200% Mormon. I did it all. I did everything. I had 4 jobs. I went to all my meetings and everything. And we actually were abstinent for a year.
Wow.
And did not have sex until after we were married.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
It was pretty hard.
I bet.
Yeah.
Obviously, he wasn't able to baptize you.
No.
What did you experience? Now, what year was this?
I was baptized in 77, and we were married in 77.
Okay. This was in the midst of the ERA and women's rights.
Right.
And coming from what you came from as far as being a free spirit, how did you wrap your mind around the patriarchal culture of Mormonism during that time?
Well, I had a lot of balls, but I was always a woman who had a weakness where it came to men. And I think it had to do with my father's early death. Having a man and being submissive to a man and being guided by a man and being wanted by a man were paramount to me. And your dad always says that the church is made up of two kinds of people, those who want to be told what to do and those who are more willing to tell them what to do.
Right.
And I was one of the ones who wanted to be told what to do. And I was happy to be told what to do by a man. And I was happy to be submissive to man and to the church.
So even though there was an inequality in the relationship, Dad was excommunicated but still attending?
Yeah.
Not able to hold the priesthood?
Nope.
Did that bother you?
Yeah.
And did you guys ever have conversations about that?
Yeah. I mean, we wanted to go to the temple. And we tried and tried and tried to figure out a way we could go to the temple. And we used to pray and pray, but it never happened.
Was there a reason why he did not? Because he's currently rebaptized.
Yes.
And he was, I mean, within the last probably, 6 or 7 years?
Yeah.
Was there a reason why he wasn't rebaptized then?
He just wasn't ready.
He wasn't ready.
He just felt like he couldn't be rebaptized and then screw up.
Okay. So was there any kind of pressure, or did you feel like you were a less worthy member because you didn't have a priesthood holder in your marriage? Because that's such an important part of having a Mormon marriage, is that you have a strong priesthood holder. Was that ever an issue?
Yeah, it was. But I had good home teachers. But one of the home teachers started seeing me alone.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. And I'll tell you right now, your dad put his foot down. Yeah.
So how long after you had been a member did you receive a patriarchal blessing?
I think it was probably about a year.
And did you prepare for that in any kind of special way?
Fasting and prayer.
And did you feel like you were going to get a good one, so to
speak?
Well,
I felt like I was ready to receive it.
Okay. And tell me what your blessing was like. Do you remember?
It was wonderful. I felt very, very moved. Even, I need to tell you a little bit about my baptism. When I was baptized, it was made clear to me that I was the only Mormon in my family history. And I experienced a feeling that went way back to the dawn of time, at the origin of my family, and I would be able to save these people by doing work for them.
Doing their temple work.
Doing their temple work.
Or their genealogy work.
And also doing their genealogy, and which I hired somebody to do their genealogy.
Because it's hard shit.
Darn straight it is. Darn straight.
So your patriarch blessing actually mentioned something pretty amazing.
Yeah, it did.
Why don't you share that?
At the time I received my patriarchal blessing, the patriarch said, while you are still in this life, your calling and election will be made sure.
And you didn't know what that meant.
I did not know what it meant. But after I had my patriarchal blessing, your dad told me that his socks had been completely knocked off. And he told me what that meant.
And what did he tell you?
He told me that I was pretty much, if I lived a righteous life, that I was guaranteed to see Christ and know Christ while I lived on this earth. And that if I lived a correct and righteous life, my calling and election to the celestial kingdom was made sure.
And so you were just on the fast track.
I was on the fast track. Got to do right.
And I'm sure that, did that make you feel special or did that add to the burden?
No, I felt.
Or both.
I felt special. I felt that I was giving it my all to do the right thing. So I felt special, and I felt that God recognized that my heart was devoted to serving Him and doing the right thing to myself and to my fellow human being.
When you eventually disaffected and you essentially gave up these beliefs, did you feel like you were throwing those things away, or how did you?
No, I just. It's like there are too many religions and there are too many people who think they're right for anybody specifically to be right. I think you got to just do the best you can.
So for you, you kind of came to a point where you acknowledged this is just what the Mormon church does and says and believes.
Right.
And I don't necessarily have to hang my entire life on this. So you and Dad get married.
Yeah, okay.
You move to Alpine.
Right. We moved to Alpine. Well, what brought us to Alpine was we went to a gallery, and we had seen in the Sunstone magazine, we had seen some of Trevor Southey's work. So when we were in Utah visiting your dad's parents and visiting with friends of your dad's in Utah, we went to a gallery and saw some of Trevor Southey's work. And we said, well, we want to see more of his work. And they said, well, he'd be happy for you to call him. So we went to his house, and we saw some more of his work and became very close friends with Trevor and Elaine. And they told us about this planned unit development community that was being founded in Highland. And that was when we fell in love with that and bought land in Highland to build our house.
And is it during this time that you became somewhat estranged?
Yes.
Okay, so yes. Tell me about that.
Okay. I have become estranged from the church, and I don't know how it came about, if I asked for the meeting or if the bishop asked if he could see me, but I told him, I will come back to the church when I see men being called to the primary as frequently as women are called to the primary.
So your balls came back. And you
darn
saw,
right.
And you were, what was it about that kind of riled you up?
Well, because women, I felt that if there was anything that kids needed was a strong male presence and a nurturing male presence. And children who are so deprived of that, for the most part, could get that in a primary teacher. Uh-huh. Something as close and fundamental as a primary teacher. But 99%, if not 100%, of primary teachers were women. And women were OD'd on little kids.
Yes.
And had nothing left to give.
Yeah. So you were really keyed into that need for more equality within the church.
Absolutely.
As far as leadership.
Yeah, that was when I was just rebelled. That was, I was over it.
And had you stopped paying your tithing?
Well, what I did, though, after that was I gave away 10% of my income to humanitarian and charitable causes.
And I'm sure they didn't like that.
No, but I liked it, and I felt like God liked it.
Okay.
But I felt it was incumbent upon me to give away 10% of my income.
I remember you telling a story recently where the bishop, when you handed the bishop, when you were paying your tithing, when you handed the bishop a check, and why don't you tell the story?
Okay. Well, that year I had made $100,000 through no fault of my own. This was my inheritance. So it like dropped out of the mailbox, you
right.
know? And so that year the bishop was a banker. And that year I gave him a check for $10,000. And he's like, "Oh, Sister Rapp, it takes a lot of faith to write a check like that." When I knew that my home teacher was a man who was a postman, and he and his wife were struggling to pay for their five children and their mortgage and all their other expenses, and the bishop had told him, "Well, brother, if you can't pay your tithing, then you need to sell your TV." And I thought that was scandalous.
Yeah.
Very unrighteous.
And that would require more faith than...
Absolutely more faith than me writing a check for $10,000 that was just one-tenth of my income.
Yeah. So you were starting to just not sit well with... How did Dad feel about that? Was he just still on his kind of cafeteria Mormon, take a little there, take a little here? Like,
yeah.
Was it...
Cafeteria.
Yeah. Was he at all upset that you were disaffecting, or did he agree with you?
Well, he was just a cafeteria Mormon. How did he feel about it? Well, I wanted him to be an ideal Mormon husband. I wanted to go to my meetings and in between time, listen to classical music, listen to the Tabernacle Choir singing, and I wanted to read scripture and talk about wonderful things between my meetings, and he wanted to take a nap.
Yeah.
Have sex.
Very spiritual.
Very spiritual.
When you moved into the planned community, Bull River.
Yeah.
You had Jensen.
Jensen.
And Caitlin hadn't been born yet, had
no,
she?
No, Caitlin was born in 82.
Okay. And I recall that there were times when I would come for, to visit that you guys were still going to church, because I would recall seeing Dad with the scriptures and you guys would go for the afternoon. So was it kind of what was causing that pull back into church and then you decide not to? What was going on with that?
I think it was just the social scene. It was just what everybody did.
Yeah, because in Bull River there were kind of a lot of
liberal Mormons,
but also the glitterati of liberal.
Glitterati, yeah.
So it was kind of to be in that social circle of liberal Mormons to kind of get your foot in to whatever was happening.
Yeah.
Okay. When it came time for, when Jensen was about, what, eight years old, I know there was a conversation as to whether or not he should be baptized.
Right. And the missionaries came over and everything.
Why don't you tell us about
that?
Well,
he said, "I don't want to get baptized and then mess up and then go to hell."
Jensen said that?
Yeah.
At what age was that?
It was about 8 or 9.
So how did the missionaries take it when a little kid says, "I just don't think I'm
well,
ready"?
Well, no, he said that to me, so I just let the missionaries know that he wasn't interested.
Oh, well, that's nice of you.
Well, thank you.
I think a lot of mothers would be a little afraid of that response.
Really?
Because if they've got a kid that thinks they might go to hell, well, shit, they better get baptized.
Oh, no way. Yeah, because that harked back at what my grandmother used to say to me. I was a very different kind of parent than I was parented.
Oh, absolutely. I would agree with that.
Yeah, sure.
Fast forward, you and Dad are now living in Salt Lake, in the Apps, where you live now.
Well, actually, we lived in Bull River for 7 years. And then our house was just way too expensive for us. And we had had some financial reversals. So at the time Caitlin was born, our house, actually, fast rewind. At the time Caitlin was born, we were still building our house in Bull River back in 82. So at the time, at that time when Caitlin was born, that was when I went to church and they were ridiculing other people's religion, and I had had it. That was it. I'd had it with the church.
Had you ever thought about formally resigning?
No, I never did. I still have visiting teachers.
Oh, no.
And I like them.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah, I still have home teachers and I like them too.
That's nice.
Yeah.
I challenged my home teachers to find me a good apostate home teacher team, and they never called back.
No, I'm sure they didn't.
So you haven't experienced any leaving the church guilt?
No.
You feel A-okay?
A-okay.
Interesting. I don't think many people feel that way.
Why? Really?
No. I think many people are terrified for a long time, and it takes them a long time to get to a place where they can really reconcile leaving and not believing anymore. Because, I mean, there's a difference between leaving the church and losing belief.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like in your story, you started to see the emperor had no clothes long before you left.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is not uncommon, but for hardcore lifelong believers, and maybe that's it because you were a convert, maybe that's why it was a little easier for you to leave it, whereas people that are born in the church, like what dad, our family comes from, what, like the four generations of pioneers and whatnot. Oftentimes it's harder for those
families. Because it's all you know.
Yeah. And it's so much of your family identity is tied up in it.
Mm-hmm.
And
your social life.
Yeah.
And your social standing.
Yes. So you were done.
Done.
Done. And dad was not officially a member. So for all intents and purposes, you had cut off relationship with the church.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're a very spiritual person.
Well, thank you.
Well, I believe it to be true.
Thank you, darling.
What kind of other spiritual means did you use to kind of enrich your life? And how did that work out for you?
Well, you know, I'm not very active spiritually anymore. I was kind of drawn to Eastern religions. When you went to Loyola in New Orleans, if you were Catholic, you had to take Catholic religion. But if you were not a Catholic, you had to take philosophy. Well, it was through the thinking along philosophical lines that I kicked Christianity originally.
Uh-huh.
So that was back when I was, 18, 19. I kicked Christianity.
But you still converted to Mormonism.
Yes, but that was a lot later on.
And also a different concept of Christianity.
Very much so.
In fact, let's talk about that for a second. Aside from the baptism, what was it about the Mormon church, being as different as it is, Joseph Smith, the Golden Plates, modern prophets, modern revelation, temple ceremonies, and the fact that you weren't able to partake in some of those, or have a priesthood holder, what interested you enough to keep you as long as it did?
I wanted to do the right thing. And I had people, there was a living prophet.
And you believed that?
I believed that. That was had a direct line to God, who could tell me what the right thing was. And all I had to do was to do it. But I found it very overwhelming. I couldn't do it all. I can remember, like, you had to have a food garden, a vegetable garden.
Yeah.
I can remember right after Jensen was born, he was a newborn baby, so I had a newborn baby. I was still bleeding from giving birth. I was out in the backyard digging a garden. And I just about snapped. And that was when your dad forbid me to go to Relief Society anymore. And that was when what's her name? Bell was the president, the general president of the Relief Society.
Uh-huh.
But I don't remember her entire name.
Sister Bell is all we ever need to know.
Sister Bell was the president of Relief Society. I got an interview with her and I said, what am I to do? I cannot do it all. I was so hard on myself. I insisted that I do it all. She said, you cannot do it all. if you have a newborn baby and the baby is crying, that baby needs you. You don't have to do it all. I was harder on myself than the church was on me because I wanted to do the right thing.
So you got some softening from the Relief Society president.
Yeah.
Did you feel like that was ever coming from the brethren?
No.
No.
But for me, it's like it's always been an all or nothing thing.
Yeah.
I can't be a cafeteria Mormon.
Yeah. I remember that you were baking bread. You were grinding wheat.
Right. Canning.
Yeah. You were like a modern day pioneer hippie.
I was.
And did you get any kind of joy out of it, or was it just drudgery?
No, I loved it. I thought I was doing the right thing.
Yeah. So all of these little things, kind of just the pain of keeping up with it, being disenchanted with the way primary was run, Dad telling you to stop going to Relief Society.
People ridiculing other religions. Laughing in gospel doctrine about other people's stupidity.
Yeah, and here we are with a hat and a rock.
Yeah, right. Got it.
And you finally just said, I'm done.
I've had it.
And so when you moved up to Salt Lake, you and Dad were pretty much probably on the same page as far as being out.
Mm-hmm.
But Dad always kept a little toe in because I remember that he was involved with the Toscanos and Lynn Whiteside. And during that whole time when the September 6th mm-hmm. were either excommunicated or disfellowshipped. Mm-hmm. So was there still a Mormon discourse going on at home?
No, I don't recall that going on.
So it was just something that he did for fun?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and also, it was the intelligentsia, and he was very, very intelligent. And so the people that he was associating with were the very, very intelligent Mormons who were creating discord.
Yeah.
In the church.
And I bet he enjoyed that.
Oh, yeah.
And were you just as disinterested as ever, or did you find it interesting to know that there was a little discord going on?
No, I was...
You were done.
I was done.
However, you recently, within the last, I don't know, what, 4 years, have found yourself kind of attached in some ways back to the church.
Yeah, when Dad came not too long ago, he's been attending church, you know, for quite a while.
And he's living in North Carolina uh-huh. with his third wife.
Yeah.
And she's no longer a member.
Not at all.
In fact, I remember her telling a story about either taking her garments and throwing them in the trash or stepping on them or something incredibly outlandish. But Dad decided to get rebaptized about 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah, and he just does his own thing and she does her own thing.
Okay. Dad, go ahead. Dad visited.
Dad visited and we started going. He was going to church. And so I started going back to church too.
With him.
With him. Yeah, I just went with him. And I just got kind of that feeling of doing the right thing again. So anyway, what happened was I really needed a job. Because you have to have a certain number of hours in order to qualify for Medicare and Social Security. And I had almost enough hours, but I needed to work for 6 months. So one of the places I applied for a job was DI. And I discovered that in order to work at DI, you had to have a bishop's referral. So I figured, okay, what I got to do is I got to go to church for a while, and then I got to meet with the bishop and tell him I desperately need a job and get a referral from the bishop, and I'll work at DI for 6 months, and then I'll have my enough hours for my Medicare and Social Security. So during that 6 months, I went to church, but I became even less involved with the church and more distant from the church and really developing a very negative attitude toward the church from working at DI.
Tell me about that. So when you went to the bishop and said, I need to get a job, and I'm thinking, you know, the DI is a good place for me to be. I just need it for a few months. What was his response?
He was okay about it. I liked the bishop, and he liked me. And I had been going to church, you know, with Dad. So He was fine about it.
He signed off on it.
Yeah, no problem.
But with the understanding that you would be required.
Well, no, there wasn't that understanding, but I figured it out that I would be.
And during that time, were you expected to pay tithing again?
No. I didn't pay tithing.
Okay. Well, that's good.
Yeah, really, huh?
It was never mentioned or alluded to.
Believe that?
I do not.
I know. You'd think he'd want the check first.
I know. Give me a check and right. Then we'll see about getting you a job.
Yeah. But this guy was really cool.
Okay. That's I liked nice. Him. Was it the one on G Street?
No, it's the one over there on Second Avenue. The old building.
Okay. So what was you said you developed a negative attitude through your experiences with DI. And tell me about that.
Oh, man. It was just the whole in-crowd thing. And we would meet early in the morning for prayer. We'd have a little spiritual meeting before we started our day. And it was just a whole, it made me want to vomit.
Now, there's a lot of refugees. Anytime I've been to DI,
yeah,
there's a lot of people that are in, you know, need a home kind of a thing. And are working at DI. What was, did you get any sense that, how did they get involved in the Mormon cog, so to speak?
I don't know, but it was a really good thing, though, because they gave people the opportunity to have an education. They would pay for people to go to school. They would buy their books. I mean, DI is a good thing. DI is a good thing that the church does.
Uh-huh. It was just the prayer in the morning that you couldn't handle?
Oh, God, no.
Wow, you were really out by then, weren't you?
I was out.
But you were going to church.
Yeah.
So were you attending all of your meetings or just sacrament?
No, I was attending them all.
How are you? I mean, I haven't sat through a sacrament meeting since probably Rand went to Afghanistan and I was there to kind of support my mom. And I don't recall a word that was said. And that was a while ago. That was like 5 years ago. So what did you think of this modern day Mormon church? Because the church you attended back in the 70s, women were not allowed to pray in sacrament meeting. Blacks did not have the priesthood yet. And you left shortly after that. So this is 20 years later. What did you think?
You know, I was bored shitless. I was absolutely bored shitless, but I had a wonderful home teacher. His first name is Juan. I don't recall his last name. But when Dad was in town and he met Juan, and he knew that Juan was my home teacher, he said, "Juan is a gift from God." And Juan was one of the Spanish-speaking, originated from Spain, and was one of the purest spirits I have ever met. He had a wonderful, pure testimony, and he was a true Christian. And I think that if and when the time comes, Juan, I hope, will someday be a general authority, because I think he would do the church a world of good. There are some people who have beautiful testimonies and who are true Christians. I don't think being a true Christian and being a Mormon are exclusive. I think a person can be a good Christian and be a Mormon. But I think the reverse is also true.
Yeah.
You can be a good Mormon and not a good Christian.
And just not a good person. So you suffered through that for 6 months, huh?
Yeah.
And you went through to Relief Society?
Yeah.
How was that different 20 years later? Was it?
Not much.
Not much different.
No.
How did the ladies in Relief Society treat you? Were they nice?
They were okay. I was pretty isolated, though, because everybody else was married, and everybody else was going to the temple, and I saw all these young women with little tiny babies. And then I remember there was one woman who was overweight, who had two little tiny babies and was pregnant. And this woman's health would be destroyed with successive pregnancies. I can remember with Caitlin, who was born in 1982 when I was, 33. I can remember I had high blood pressure with Caitlin. And I can imagine that this woman's health would be ruined with pregnancies.
So you still feel like there was the message was still pretty loud and clear to have children.
Oh, yes.
I think I remember you telling me that you sat through a general conference where it was the first time that the general authorities or the prophet, I don't know who it was, had specifically said explicitly, should maybe be a better way to say it, to have as many children as you could.
Yeah.
How did that message come across?
Interestingly enough, when I was in Fresno, the state president addressed a Sunday school class, and he said, I have been to Utah and seen women whose bodies are desecrated by having repeated pregnancies and numerous children. That is not expected of you. You need to protect your health. You need to have as many children as are right for you.
So you were seeing that there was one message that was being given to the congregation, but then thankfully for many hundreds and probably thousands of women, there were some leaders in the church who were willing to say, you know what, that is unacceptable,
right,
and we're not going to teach our members this.
Right. And, you know, you hear this a lot, but the church in the quote-unquote mission field is very different from the church in Utah.
Oh, absolutely.
Very different. It's vital. It's getting a constant influx of new blood with converts.
Yeah.
And it has a tendency to be much more Christian instead of just this dead, gangrenous Mormon, I don't even know what to call it, appendage that there is in Utah.
Yeah.
Stifling.
Do you think that there's a chance that you would have stayed in the church had you not moved to Utah?
Not if I were married to your dad.
Because?
Because I wanted a man who had the priesthood. And that was just, it was never going to happen.
So in some ways, moving to Utah is what kept your marriage intact,
mm-hmm,
because you got to see the church for
exactly
what it is.
Yeah.
How long have you been done with DI?
Let's see. This is 12, so it must have been probably about 4 years ago.
Okay. And
they did let me stay for 6 months, which was really unusual. They really bent over backwards to help me, because they understood that I needed to stay for 6 months. Generally, they let you stay at DI for 3 months,
okay,
and that's it.
So they were very helpful.
Yes.
That's nice. So when you were done with DI and done with attending for 6 months, have you gone back since?
No. No. As a matter of fact, I read The 19th Wife.
Did I let you borrow that book?
You either told me about it. I may have gotten it from the library, but I thought I wasn't going to finish it in time to get it back to the library.
That's right.
And I bought it.
That's right.
So now I have also lent it now to an ex-Mormon friend.
Oh, nice.
But I read 19th Wife, which just rankled me about Mormonism and the ugliness that Brigham Young was, and the ugliness of the early church, and the ugliness of plural marriage. And then I saw the entire run of Big Love, which just nauseated me. It just felt like somebody was strangling me, and I was just trying to throw up, but somebody was strangling me, and I couldn't even throw up.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you have a disdain for the church now.
I abhor it.
And what would you say the number one reason for that is? I mean, obviously what you just described as far as the early church and plural marriage, but as someone who's removed from it now, and as, you know, a grown woman, a grandmother, what is it that you think, what is the Mormon church in your opinion?
Well, again, you know, I think for some people it's a very good thing. I asked your dad, he said that there were so many well-educated people in Utah. And I said, what do you attribute that? And he said, the church. And I said, okay, now you come from somewhat humble circumstances, at least compared to what I came from. To what do you attribute your refinement? He said, the church. And I think for some people it can, okay, here's my deal. I think for some type B people, the church can be a very good thing. It can uplift them and help them to accomplish things they wouldn't otherwise accomplish in life, not only scholastically, but just as being fine, refined human beings. But for type A people, I think it's death.
And why is that?
Because of what I was telling you before about me being bleeding out there digging a vegetable garden.
Yeah.
I was just chasing my tail and going crazy.
So do you consider yourself a believer in any one philosophy now that you've left Mormonism?
No.
Has the experience of Mormonism at all disenchanted you from religious paths?
Not really. You know, my daughter Caitlin and I were talking the other day, and we were saying, you know, there are thousands of religions in this world, and every one of their devotees think that theirs is the true religion. And Caitlin's boyfriend and I were talking, and we were saying that people have been devoted Muslims since time immemorial, since mankind and womankind was on this earth. And there are more people that are devoted to Islam than there are any other religion on the planet. Are they wrong? Who's right? And I have to say, nobody's right. They're all right. Nobody's right. It's just, you just got to do the best you can.
Is there any final parting words that you would say as far as your experience in and out of Mormonism and doing the best you can?
Yeah. You know, that's the old saying. It's just, you gotta just be the best possible person you can. There's a movie that said, you know, just be decent to each other.
Wasn't that Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure?
I don't think so. I think it was. Is that Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure?
I think it is.
Well, there you go. Maybe I'm a devotee of Bill and Ted religion.
Oh, Mama.
There you go.
Well, I adore you. Thank you so much for doing this interview.
It's been a joy. Thank you for having me.
I love you, Mama.
I love you, darling.
Well, everybody, this has been Amy for Voices and Mormon Expression, and we appreciate you listening, and we hope to see you again. Good night.
Letting go has not been easy, but I don't need you loving me for who you think I should be. No, I'm standing here at the end of who I once was, not sure yet.
This episode was hosted and directed by Amy, produced by Heather, and the theme music was provided by McCall Erickson. Thank you for listening. Mormon Expression Voices is a production of the Whitefields Educational Foundation. Find us on the web at whitefieldseducational.org. The Mormon Expression and Mormon Expression Voices podcasts, as well as other educational initiatives, are made possible by your generous donations. Please consider a subscription today.